The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello friends, I'm your host Chris Thrall. I'm a former Royal Marines Commando. I've adventured, for better and sometimes worse, across 80 countries on all 7 continents. Welcome to the Bought the T-Shirt podcast. Gary McKinnon, how are you, sir?
I'm very well, Mr. Thrall. How are you doing?
Oh, mate, it's so great to finally chat with you on the show. I mean, we've been friends now online for several years. You've always been a big supporter of the channel. Your story is just absolutely unreal.
7 years to wait around to see if you're going to be extradited for this? It's awful.
He's being done by a law that was put into place for terrorism post 9/11. And this guy just isn't a terrorist. You know, it's mad to sort of treat him as if he's a fully blown terrorist sort of chap.
Let's take it from the beginning. What computer system did you have back then?
An early PC, a 386 maybe. Oh, no, Pentium. 56k dial-up modem, so quite slow. You know, it took about 5 minutes to download 1 megabyte.
What was it we had at school? Was it Acorn we used to have or something?
BBC Micros and
Did you get into computers then?
I had one of the first Ataris when it had the little membrane keyboard. And that Atari 2600 video game console, you know, playing tanks with a joystick. That was probably late 70s, early 80s. And then I got a proper computer, and still an Atari, a little basic cartridge, started loads of programming basic. And yeah, that was my start. That's when I got hooked on computers.
How did it come around then? I mean, how does a person hack in to, what was it? Was it, do you want to tell it? Was it the CIA and NASA?
It was Army, Navy, Air Force, and NASA.
Okay. Yep. And how did you decide that would be a good idea? Is it fair to say your Asperger's had a bearing in that decision? Or
yeah, after the diagnosis, I was told that it's typical of Asperger's sufferers, or whatever you want to call them, to have these sort of truth crusades and feel like, you know, they're going to do something that will help the world, get some truth out about something. So that helped explain it a bit to me, because my mates at school always thought I was a bit weird. They used to call me Robot. I was very still and quite obsessive with things. I'd get into something and just, you know, try and knock it out of the park if I could for a long time.
It's funny when we talk about personality orders, I'm not going to say disorder, like I'm always getting accused of having a few, people think I'm ADHD and all this sort of stuff.
Yeah, a couple of psychologists that analysed me, they said that they thought I showed signs of ADHD and a little bit of bipolar, but they love their labels, don't they? You know.
Have you ever heard of Da Vinci syndrome?
No.
Or Da Vinci personality. It's basically what they reckon Leonardo da Vinci was, because he was a genius, wasn't he?
Yeah.
But apparently it's people that get onto things like projects that they want to, and they just go hell for leather for it. You know, work like 48 hours in a row because they just love. And then when the product's like almost finished and they prove that they just lose interest.
I'm no genius, but that sounds like me, that part.
Yeah, somebody said to me, hey Chris, you realize you're just like a typical Da Vinci personality. Very I think in touch with your right brain as well. having Asperger's, do you think you weren't able to think of the consequences?
I knew the consequences. Apparently, I'm quite low on the spectrum. You know, I'm not sort of full-blown autistic. But the consequences in our country would have been 6 months in prison at worst under the Computer Misuse Act, 1995 or six, whatever it was. And at best, a few weeks community service. So it was only later on that it turned into facing 70 years in an American jail and being threatened with Guantanamo Bay and being prosecuted under military order number one, secret trials, no press allowed. It just got, you know, ridiculously off the scale.
And how old were you when you did the hacking?
36 when I got arrested, so about 35 when I started.
Gaz, you can tell your story. Was it, were you looking for UFO evidence? Is that, that's what I think I heard.
Yep, obsessed by UFOs. And I'd read a book by a bloke called Stephen Greer called The Disclosure Project. And he did amazing work. He had about 400 witness testimonies. And these were people, they were in, you know, civilian air traffic control, military radar operators, some were in the CIA, some were in the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency. Some were responsible for whether or not to launch nuclear missiles, Strategic Air Command. So some really credible, serious men and women. And they were all telling these incredible stories about what they'd seen on radar and multiple witnesses, multiple radar contacts.
There's a whole fleet of them. Look on the ASA. My gosh. They're all going against the wind. The wind's 120 knots to the west. Hold that thing, dude. That's not our LNS, though, is it?
It's not. That is an LNS, dude.
Well, if there's like...
Look at that thing!
It's rotating.
And one particular witness, she worked at NASA. She was a NASA launch slide specialist. So she took photographs, all the rocketry, all the hardware. And she had secret clearance because she took some, you know, fairly close-up photos and stuff. And you'd see technical details would be revealed if you knew what you were looking at. And she worked, her story was, she was working in Johnson Space Center. And she said she worked in Building 8. It's a very specific location. And that across the corridor from her, she had a colleague. And this chap called her across one day. He said, Donna, come and look at this. And he shows her one of the photographs because he was a photography expert as well. And he points to this. It's a high-res satellite imagery and of the Earth. And he pointed to this big white disc in the photo above the trees. And this is the days of analog photography. So she said, oh, is it a blob on the emulsion? You know, the way they used to develop it, putting it through the silver water. And he said, yeah, but Donna, blobs in the emulsion don't have shadows. And then he pointed out the shadow that was conforming to the terrain beneath. And he said, it's a flying saucer. And his job, this whole room was a laboratory that NASA had dedicated to airbrushing out the UFOs from their satellite imagery because they were so common. They saw them all the time, yeah. And because NASA sells on the imagery to universities and stuff, they had to have this airbrushing lab to remove them, remove any sign of it. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, well, crikey, that's very specific. Johnson Space Center. I was either already in Johnson Space Center with the hacking, or I've definitely been in other space centers. And the technique I used to get in was blank password scanning. There was no security whatsoever. They had no firewalls. You know, if you log on at an office, your name's Chris, your password's Royal Marine. They had literally no password. It was blank. So I wrote a very simple script in a programming language called Perl. And it could scan like 65,000 PCs in about 8 minutes once I was on a fast network. And it would retrieve all the PCs with blank passwords, but then I'd have to manually connect to them to have a look. That was a slow part, searching the files, etc. So I did that same technique on Building 8 on Johnson Space Center. Used various Windows admin commands to strip out all the machines that were actually in Building 8. And luckily, NASA were very good at their auditing, and they'd fill in all the comment fields. So I knew which machines were in Building 8. Same blank password scanning technique. And there were only about a dozen that were in Building 8. But the first one I looked at, really conformed to what Donna said. Normally you'd go in these machines and it's like anyone's desktop, because I was using remote control software, a bit like PC Anywhere. So you can move the mouse and click on the folders and all that business. But these machines just had two folders. One was called raw and one was called processed or filtered and unfiltered. And I thought, well, this sounds like just what she said, you know, in comes the pictures with the UFOs in them and out goes the processed ones with a bare brushed amount. And I double clicked in that folder and I'm looking at the picture files, the image files, and they're in a proprietary NASA format, not JPEGs or GIFs or anything I was used to. And so I realized I didn't have this software to look at them. And also they were like 200, 300 megabytes in size, really big files for the day, because it would take 5 minutes just to download 1 megabyte. So hours and hours for me to download one of these. So my only option, and I was conscious of time as well, in case, you know, I got caught, was just to double click on one and see it appear. You know, the associated software would launch. But because this application I was using was very slow, I had to turn down the color to, I think, maybe 2-bit or 4-bit color, turn the resolution down to about 640 by 480. Mm-hmm. And then you see this picture start to appear. And at first it's just sort of black and gray. Then you see the hemisphere of a planet. And then I saw this tube shape appear. And it was, I mean, this was low resolution, low color, but it was definitely some kind of craft floating above the hemisphere of the planet. And it came down more. And it was a classic tube-shaped cigar, cigar-shaped UFO, but slightly flattened at the ends, which you don't hear many reports about. But it did also have, the only thing that looked man-made about it was, you know, like the radar stations at Menwith Hill look like golf balls, the yes. sort of geodesic pattern. It had those on it, above and below, and to the left and to the right. And but it had no seams or rivets or panels or writing or exhaust ports or rockets or engines, anything like that. So it looked either not man-made or really futuristic, you know, like some kind of secret technology. And so this was my eureka moment. You know, I'd confirmed Don Hare's story. I was getting a picture. I was thinking, oh, I can send it to the newspapers. I can do all this, do all that, blow it all out of the water. And then someone was on the bloody machine, weren't they? I saw the mouse move over to the bottom right-hand side where your clock is. And he brought up the LAN icon, local area network icon. He right-clicked, pop-up menu comes up. He chose disconnect. And that was me, shut out.
Wow.
So yeah, it's my eureka moment, but also my oh shit moment, you know.
Let's come on, Gaz, and talk about how they tracked you. I'm guessing IP address or something, but UFOs. So three things come to my mind, either like a NASA project, an actual vehicle that they've designed, or yeah. some military industrial type vehicle, or an interdimensional vehicle from the multiverse, as it were,
yeah,
or an actual like physical geographical vehicle that goes from one planet to another. What do you think we could be talking here?
Coupled with the only other document I found was a spreadsheet on I'm pretty sure it was on a Navy system. And this spreadsheet was called Non-Terrestrial Officers, which got me, you know, very excited. And it had lists of people's names, lists of ships' names, you know, an Excel spreadsheet with multiple tabs. And it had lists of exotic materials like a barium titanate and strontium and, you know, some I couldn't even pronounce, like molybdenum. I still can't pronounce that one. And really weird, like heavy metals and strange, just really strange stuff. And ship-to-ship transfers, fleet-to-fleet transfers, loads of tabs on this. And I thought, well, non-terrestrial officers, I don't think it is little green men. So I surmise in the end that coupled with the image, that maybe there's a secret space force, basically. And that's what it pointed to, rather than, you know, aliens.
Could they keep something like that a secret?
Yeah, I'm sure they can keep secrets. I mean, lots of these people, they work as well on what they call SCI, secret compartmental information. So everyone does a part of the job, but no one's got the big picture. And also, you know, they sign the American version of the Official Secrets Act. So you're in a world of shit if you spill the beans.
And so going back to then, to how did they track you? How did you know that you were really in the shit?
Yeah, I got a bit a bit, the old ego started running away with me. I thought, God, this is way too easy. This got a bit of megalomania set in. And I started being sloppy because I used to cover my tracks. I'd like hack into an American library or, you know, something at a university, and then from there to somewhere else, and then from there into like a low-level military network, like a logistics or support or something. And once you're on those networks, the other networks automatically trust you because you're coming from a military IP. But I started just doing a direct connection or just one jump or two jumps. And so I'm pretty sure that's how they caught me. And I was using different dial-up accounts at the time. AOL was popular. There were other ones. And they never actually told me how they caught me, but I think it was British Telecom I was using at the time when I was caught, British Telecom dial-up. My girlfriend's, unfortunately, she wasn't happy about that. And yeah, all they had to do was say to British Telecom, oh, we had this IP address on this date at this time. Can you tell us who the owner is? So the police, when they came around to arrest me, it was like 8 o'clock in the morning. They'd been up all night anyway, felt like crap. And suddenly I've got an officer wagging his finger in my face while I'm lying in bed. And they said they only knew the address. They didn't know, you know, who was operating the PC. They just knew that it was from that address and that it was in my girlfriend at the time's account. So they said I was actually under physical surveillance for like a week or so before they made the arrest. But they soon realized that whoever it was hardly left the house. You know, I wasn't even getting dressed in them days, probably not even washing half the time. Sitting up drinking beer, getting a bit stoned on the old wacky backy, having a little adventure, really. Yeah, totally obsessed. God, it's funny thinking back on it. But
it was the UK cops, I'm guessing, that knocked on your door.
Yeah, they're now called SOCA, Serious Organised Crime Agency. Back then they were called NHTCU, National High Tech Crime Unit. And yeah, they're the ones that knocked on the door.
Did they drag you away there and then?
Yeah, they did a big search first. And I had about six PCs in the kitchen at that point. I was fixing four of them for mates, and two of them were the two I used. And they took my mates' PCs, took my PCs, and unfortunately went upstairs because me and my girlfriend were renting the room at the bottom of the house off her auntie who lived upstairs. And they raided the aunt's house. And so there's the horrible spillover domino effect for the other people. Yep, took all the stuff, handcuffs in the back of the meat wagon, down to the police station, Belgravia, I think it was, they took me to. And, oh no, that was a second arrest because I got rearrested. Yeah, went for questioning and stupid me didn't ask for a lawyer. I just flapped straight away because I knew it was all on my hard drive. So, you know, there'd be no point trying to lie or hide anything because all the evidence was there. So I just, you know, admitted to everything, which they loved, of course. And then some months went by. And the NHTCU officers both went over to Washington and they spoke with the Office of Naval Intelligence. And when the NHTCU came back from that, it was a very different mood. They'd obviously been, you know, very impressed by the top brass at Washington and were taking it very seriously now. You know, oh, this guy's a major threat to security and he damaged all our systems and took down a naval weapons station and, you know, the usual. My friend Matthew Bevan, his hacker handle was DataStream Cowboy. He got caught in 96, I think it was. And they called him the biggest threat to national security since Hitler. So they really love bigging you up, you know, make you look like something you're not, something far worse, like a huge threat.
What year was yours, Gaz?
I was arrested in March 2002 and I was doing the hacking during 2001.
Ah, so you hit the sweet spot right after the events in New York and Washington, yes.
Yep. Terrible yes. Time to be caught.
Oh. Well, yeah, that's just a whole nother subject again, isn't it?
Yep.
Slipping in the loss of freedoms and the enhanced security protocols and going through the airports and taking your shoes off and just all part of the New World Order.
The Patriot Act.
It's pretty terrifying being arrested, right? When you the reality that, oh my God, I could actually lose my freedom now.
Yeah, it reminded me of, I can't remember the film, but there was a film where one of the lines in it was, always listen to your girlfriend. So what are you doing that for? Stop doing that. But yeah, that was the first arrest. I wasn't in a cell then. It was just questioning, and then a second round of questioning when they came back from Washington, and they had a much more serious tone then, you know. So the first arrest was March, and that interview then. The second arrest, well, not arrest, but the second interview was June or July, early summer, and they were a lot more serious. And then the threat of extradition came in November, and that's when I knew it was really serious, because it turned from 6 months in prison or a few weeks community service under the Computer Misuse Act in Britain to 70 years in an American jail on paper, because there was 7 counts and 10 years per count. And but it was a complete fit-up. They for it to be an extraditable offence, it has to be worth at least 1 year in prison over there. And for it to be a computer crime worth 1 year in prison, you had to have caused at least $5,000 worth of damage. So they said that I'd caused exactly $5,000 damage on every computer I'd been on, you know. And I didn't do any damage. I was trying to maintain my presence there and use them to jump through and, you know, find what I wanted to find. And I mean, if I had done damage, they obviously weren't buying the computers at PC World, were they? $5,000, what the hell? And even the Crown Prosecution Service, when they asked for evidence of damage, they couldn't provide any because they hadn't done any. So the CPS ended up saying, well, this is just hearsay. It's basically gossip, you know. But yeah, the real threat was in November when it was extradition. And that was, you know, just very heavy. That's when, you know, the doom and gloom set in. And as you say, you start thinking, my God, what have I done? You know, why has it got to this? Because that's your whole life gone.
Let's be honest. You did them a favor. Well, first of all, doesn't it just show that the Russians must have been in there way before you or the Chinese? I mean, these people aren't stupid. This is their bread and butter. So clearly, you know, it's not confidential. I think all the countries are controlled.
Oh, you're bang on, pal. When I was in there, I could do various network commands. You can do a NetStack command to see who else is connected to the machine. Turkey, Holland, all the European countries, because there was no passwords. So I was definitely not the only person on there, you know, because it was that bloody easy. And so God knows what other foreign governments were doing.
Exactly. And any judge with an ounce of humanity, which, let's be honest, I don't know how many of them have any, but... would just say, listen, son, you've actually done us a favor. You've shown that we've got a back door here that we need to shut. You're just a
very widespread one.
You know, you're 35. There was no malintent. That's the human way to go around it.
Yeah, and that would have been the British way.
Yeah, 70 Definitely. Years. It just makes a mockery of the American system, doesn't it?
Yeah, but as you pointed out earlier, because it was right after 9/11. They really wanted a poster boy for this, because there's a government report by the General Accounting Office every year, and they get like 250,000 attacks and a penetration attempts or whatever, but they call them attacks. And every year they're never up to scratch. They're never up to scratch according to the federal guidelines set down for military and government computer networks. So yeah, I mean, I'm sure they did take it as a lesson, but they really wanted some revenge as well. And to have a poster boy to say, look, this is what happens to you if you do get caught. And even better that I was British, because, you know, we're an ally, supposedly. So they could say, we don't care if you're from an ally country, you're still going to get your ass kicked and heavily punished. So it was a bad time to be caught.
Mate, you should have gone and hid in a cave in Afghanistan, and then you'd been all right. What was the stress like? I mean, I've had things where, I mean, I've had a work tribunal, and just being suspended from work, and then you've got to fight your case and which I did win, actually. In case anyone's wondering, but I just remember the stress was through the roof, and I hated the fact that other people can. I wasn't as spiritual as I am now, and so back then, you know, other people they could stress me out, and it was awful. Waking up like 3:30 in the morning, just wide awake, wired, yep, on stress. And
that sounds familiar.
And you went through 10 years of it.
Yeah,
lots of beers.
Yeah, I mean, when I could afford to, because of course I lost my job as well. I lost the girlfriend, lost the job, lost the flat. Then I was on the dole. I was on the dole for 10 years. I don't know anyone else that's managed that one, but they were very sympathetic at my local signing on office. But yeah, so yeah, I used to get me gyro king for a weekend, get absolutely smashed, try and forget all about it. But yeah, stress is stress, whether it's relationships, your mortgage, your money, or government. We all experience the same stress if it's something serious in your life. But the worst thing about this was how long it went on. And the news, you know, the news just got badder and badder every time through the appeals process, lost again, got to reappeal, blah, blah, blah. I don't like banging on about, you know, how bad it was for me, because, you know, there's other people who've gone through a lot worse. Because it was over a long time, it just gradually wore away at you. Because I've always been pretty chilled and, you know, not bad at coping with stress. But the length of time as it wore on, it was just worse and worse. And eventually in 2008, I gave up. Basically, I thought, oh, this is just, I'm going to be taken over there. And I did some research and I bought potassium chloride, which is one of the three chemicals used in the lethal injection. And I bought enough, you know, so many grams per kilogram of body weight, so that if I did get the bad news, I could just drink that in some water and your heart stops, you know, nice, fast, easy way to go. Because I thought, fuck it, I'm not spending 70 years in an American jail. I'm not giving my life, although I would be giving my life if I took it, but I'm not, you know, giving them my time. I really would much rather, just top myself rather than be over there for 70 years. It was bad. The stress was bad.
You also had the media obviously knocking at your door and wanting statements and press releases and all this sort of stuff.
Yeah, and that was good. Got a lot of media support in Britain. And a few celebrities got on board, you know, people that I'd loved and admired in my youth, like Pink Floyd, Crosby, Stills and Nash, Chrissie Hynde from The Pretenders. Bob Geldof, yeah. Well, and so that was mental.
And how did they get so galvanized? Was it the simple injustice of it all?
Yeah, and also we had someone we knew someone else that knew someone else that knew David Gilmour and Pink Floyd. So once he was on board, a couple of other people thought, oh, well, that's, you know, obviously an injustice, and he's a British guy. And Trudy, Sting's wife, she was great, you know, for years supporting us. So, yeah, it was amazing to have that support. It makes you feel better, even if you think it might not be able to help legally. It's just nice having that kind of spiritual support, you know, just or psychological support, whatever you want to call it. So that was good. And the Daily Mail, of course, eventually ran a campaign, you know, so that was incredible. That really helped to avoid the extradition, really, because one of the few ways to make MPs sit up and listen is to have very big publicity, you know, big media on your side. So that helped humongously. Yeah.
One thing I noticed is you look pretty cool through it all. I mean, you was always dressed smart. You had some cool suits, didn't wear a tie, which is, you know, back in the days when this started to become trendy not to wear a tie. I think, did I see some aviator sunglasses and a leather jacket or two? You look quite a cool dude, and you look like you was on top of it all. I'm just wondering if this went against you, or did they speak to you about your image? Or
it's funny you say that, because I was on Richard and Judy once, and there was people in the Guardian newspaper, boo, that were commenting, oh, look, he's on television, he can't even get a proper suit. Look at his horrible cheap suit. I thought, God, is that really your takeaway from this, my cheap bloody suit that I'm wearing? But no, I've always, they say this is part of the Asperger's as well, a bit of a stone face. So, I mean, like right now doing it, I still get nervous doing video interviews, especially at the beginning. I've warmed up a bit now. But I'm from like the, you know, the Clint Eastwood school of, like, my dad was very stoic, you know, only spoke when he had to spoke, that kind of thing. So I was brought up a bit like that. So I do have a poker face thing going on anyway. But also apparently the Asperger's does that as well. Not very emotional. But I've kind of...
I said this to you earlier. You are literally like the best podcast guest. I mean, in terms of sometimes you have to pause the recording and because your guest keeps going back and forward like this and it's really off-putting, or a lot of people tap the table out of nerves.
The camera shakes, yeah.
The camera shakes. Oh, sorry, folks. I've just done it myself. The camera shakes, but the microphone, especially if you've got a microphone cable, picks it all up. Sometimes it's almost unsalvageable. And you don't do it. You have got none of this. Is it good countenance, I think, is the word. So, yeah, I hope you've got a bright future of podcasting or certainly podcasts in front of your guests.
Well, it's funny you should say that. I might be starting my own podcast, but I can't talk much about it at the minute, so I'll be following your footsteps.
Yes.
Oh, talking about following your footsteps, it was you that inspired me to start working out again and getting fit, so thank you.
Yeah, absolutely welcome. Absolutely welcome. It's quite funny, the amount of people that have been on my podcast and they've got podcasts and they don't invite me on it.
I'll invite you.
I think a lot of people aren't ready for the truth in this. Like, they're not ready for a truth conversation.
Yeah.
They're just quite sort of just maybe on the fringes of the matrix. And yeah, it's just quite funny that we put a lot of effort in. Well, Luke certainly does. You know, I'll sit in the chair and chat for anything up to 3 hours with someone, which I love, and that's great. But then Luke will go and spend a whole day, possibly 2 days, editing not editing stuff out. We never do that unless we're going to get in trouble with YouTube. But
yeah,
editing together the montage, info about the guests, putting some images in and all this sort of stuff. We do all that effort for our guests. Our guests will get, God, you know, thousands of our subscribers. My invite onto your show? Oh, yeah. And you can tell they're flanneling, like they're like us. But no, good effort, mate. Good effort. You're a great podcast guest. So,
yes, pal.
What was it? These celebrities, did you meet them all in person?
No, unfortunately not. But I did get to meet Chrissy Hynde, who I'd always fancied anyway when I was little, and she's still hot. But that was a really weird day. I went in to actually record a song with her because we recorded a song to like a sort of campaign song. And I was really depressed, really moody. And you're meeting, you know, one of your musical heroes. And then the blokes, because they were filming it as well, and the blokes that were recording it and filming it said, "Gary, can you smile a bit when you're singing?" I just said, "Look, I can't smile. I've got nothing to smile about at the minute." But so it was a weird little dichotomy there, being meeting someone you like so very much, but feeling like shit for the whole day.
And it's all quite surreal, this as well, you know, rock stars and prime ministers, and it's just all a bit mad. But it was great to hear him say that he was sympathetic. And, you know, we'll just have to see how it plays out.
Theresa May, she said, no, put a foot down about this. It's
yep.
Yep, I mean, I'm sure. Was it her personal decision, do you think? Or do you think she was advised that, look, this is not a good idea?
Yeah, that's the thing about governments. It's never their personal decision. Governments are just a facade for people that are ignorant of the real mechanisms of control and power in this country. The real control and power is with all the departments that underlie every government, whether it's left, right, and liberal, monster raven, loony party, you know.
And they're all controlled by the big club.
yeah. It's your foreign office, your home office, Crown Prosecution Service, all those departments, customs and excise, all the crown departments. That's who really runs the show. But yeah, Theresa May, yeah, under, it was the medical evidence. And they tried to do a hatchet job on that as well. They wanted another guy to interview me who I knew didn't like me and had tried a hatchet job previously. So we said, look, we've done three assessments, plus about five before the three that were on paper, for the time. And we said, we're not doing any more. And we just stood our ground. It was a bit of a risk, but eventually, yeah, Theresa May was advised and took the advice that she should block the extradition on human rights grounds. And then a couple of years later, Theresa May was looking like she was the architect of the destruction of the Human Rights Act in Britain. So that was a bit strange.
It's she once famously said in an interview, I said, "Theresa, what's like the naughtiest thing you've done in your life?" And she said, "Oh, I once ran across a cornfield when I was a little girl."
Oh, the freedom.
And the The commentator went, yeah, none of them drone strikes that you ordered then on an innocent population. Yes, but well, at least she did. At least she got something right, mate. Hey, what was the relief like?
Yeah. Oh, I cried like a baby. Cried like a bloody baby. Yeah, just, you know, 10 years of tears. It was unbelievable. Yeah, and all that pent up stress. You know, yeah, hugging everyone that was there.
Did you have to go to court to hear this verdict? Or
no, I got it on the phone. Then I think an hour later, it was announced on television.
Bloody hell.
And I have to mention Karen Todner, my lawyer, because she was bloody amazing. She stuck with us for 10 years, appeal after appeal, you know, judicial process after judicial process, never gave up. Incredible woman, incredible lawyer.
And you've got no sort of right to recourse, have you? Because as far as the Yanks are concerned, you're still like, they still want you. You're still guilty. So it's not like you can sue them for 10, I mean, 10 years of that amount of stress. We know what it does to the human body and the lingering effects it has in our mind.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's the sort of thing you could sue people for, but I wouldn't want to anyway, you know, another long court case.
Yeah, yeah, of course. Just sometimes best to move on.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
We chatted briefly, didn't we, about this chat GPT, which I keep, one of my friends keeps asking me about. And do you have any views on algorithms and Silicon Valley software?
Yeah, I was programming AI in the 80s with, you know, the early neural networks. And I haven't used ChatGPT yet and I haven't looked at the code. But there's no such thing as artificial intelligence. It's very impressive. And if you don't know how it works, it can look intelligent, but it's not. It's basically large scale pattern matching with very highly optimized search algorithms. But it can produce stuff that really does wow you, whether it's graphical or it's text like ChatGPT. So yeah, it is impressive, but I just hope we get some good uses for AI, you know, like, they do use it in medical for like early recognition of breast cancer, stuff like that. So that's the good uses.
Yeah.
ChatGPT, I know, is going to be huge commercially because it basically can write content about anything for anyone. So goodbye copywriters, they're going to be out of a job. And that's the worst thing about AI and robots, isn't it? It's people losing their jobs.
Yes. Just for our friends at home, just to explain to you, if you're not aware of what ChatGPT is, which is the next big thing from Silicon Valley, it's basically a computer program that anyone can access. I think you have to set up an account, and then you can speak into your microphone or type a question in on your keyboard and say, ChatGPT, write me an essay on the difference between seals and sea lions, but do it in the style of William Shakespeare. And you will get back within about something crazily, you know, a few seconds, this whole 3,000 word essay written in the style of show. It would be, oh, wherefore art thou sea lion that is different to thou seal, thus not. Students are already using it to cheat their university assignments because you can't tell this has been written by a machine, apparently. Joseph Paul Watson did a video the other day which highlights the where this is going to be used against us. And as I was explaining to Gazala, he asked it some questions such as, could you provide me with a damning indictment of Joe Biden, President Joe Biden? And the response from ChatGPT was, no, sorry, we're not allowed to, you know, persecute individuals. It's against our policy. And then Joseph asks it, could you give us a damning indictment of Donald Trump? Donald Trump is a misogynistic, woman abuse. It clearly, just in the same way Google is, clearly biased, Gaz, hey?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I work in search engine optimization, getting people's websites to the top of Google for their product or services. And it won't give you, because normally you can look up how many people search for a given thing. It gives you the monthly search volume. So, you know, 10 million people might be searching for red leather shoes every month or whatever. But if Google thinks that your particular market is nefarious or bad for some reason, like I had one client run an escort agency. It won't give you search volumes in escort agencies. It won't give you search volumes on CBD oil, although that may have changed now, I'm not sure, or cannabis, or, you know. So they do act like the BBC, a bit of a nanny state thing going on, you know, like they're the gatekeeper of what's right and what's wrong and what you can and can't see.
It's all stacked against us, but I think it all comes so incrementally, so slower than people can perceive. We're used to doing stuff day to day. And if we want change, like we want it tomorrow, you know, yeah. You decide to buy a new car. You don't do it incrementally over like a 40, 50 year period. You just want it now. Whereas the controllers, they play a very long game from what I can see. We're talking like over centuries.
Absolutely. Yeah, because they have the history to look back on.
Yes.
And, a lot of them, you know, public school educations, much better educations than we get in the state. So the memory of government is very long, as you say, centuries, if not millennia. Whereas we just live generation to generation. All we know is what our mum and dad told us.
I think also when you buy into the doctrine of, if we call it the dark side, there must be something in there that your efforts still come to fruition, even though you'll be dead long before, for example, the New World Order has finally put the capstone on its pyramid. There's something there that drives people to be part of this long-term experiment, even though they're going to be dead long before it, you know, long before we're all enslaved. There must be some, they're getting, I don't know if they think they're getting closer to God or something. Or
yeah, power, recognition, place in the history books, that sort of thing.
Yes. So one final thing, Gaz, this made me smile. You put a photo on Twitter of you and your mate stoned.
Yeah.
It just brought back memories, I think, of every like youngsters when they're up in their bedroom, like blowing it out the window, big red eyes.
Yeah, they pupils.
Yes, were they? Do you look back at those days with fondness? Or?
Oh yeah, yeah, I'd always dabbled in drugs, LSD, mushrooms. Yeah, mind expanding in moderation. But obviously, you know, I've known a couple of people that have gone too far and gone on to harder things for longer. And two of my friends died of smack, heroin overdose.
Mm, yeah.
Don't go too far and make it all about the drugs.
For certain people, especially those that come from quite a traumatized background, this, I don't want to keep saying the keywords, but like that way of life can unlock certain qualities that you didn't know you had, or certain talents, and help you frame trauma in a more productive way so it just doesn't control you for the rest of your life. But then for those of us that we're also predisposed, those kind of people are quite predisposed to addiction because of the nature you're escaping from this underlying trauma that constantly has you in its grip. And and that's why you see people, you know, they go past the honeymoon stage, don't they? It's like,
totally.
It was good back in the day. We've all moved on, but you're still like, and.
Yeah, because for a while it gives you an answer, doesn't it? It gives you a place to hide, a different outlook. Yes.
Gaz, look, this has been a great chat. Is there anything you need to promote? Do you offer your computing services or your internet services to, that sounded a bit, Wait, then, didn't it?
Well, just a search engine optimization. If you've got a website and you want to get out there on Google, I don't charge a lot, and I do good work, and I'm honest, which is rare these days. smallseo.co.uk.
Yeah, stay on the line so I can thank you properly, but just great to see you again. absolutely fascinating chat. I'm sure we're going to have many more. I'm sure there's many topics that we can that we can cover. And I know there's so many people out there are going to be delighted that we've had this conversation. So massive thank you to you, and glad that you got your freedom.
Thanks to you, pal. It's great to be on.
Yeah, and is your mum still with us?
Yeah, mum and stepdad, because my stepdad did a lot as well, but he was behind the scenes, didn't want to be on camera and stuff.
Yeah. We'll give our best wishes to your dear mum, and
we'll do.
She certainly deserves some recognition.
Cheers, Chris. Lovely.
As do our wonderful subscribers and friends out there who are watching this. If you could like and subscribe, folks, if you're not, click the notification bell. We just try to bring you the best content we can. We have the chats that not a lot of other people have. And we certainly try to do them in the most interesting way. Much love, everyone. Thank you.
Cheers, Chris.
Cheers, buddy.
Friends, thank you for listening to the Bought the T-Shirt podcast. Please like, subscribe, and share. And don't forget to follow me on social media. Username, Chris Thrall. Instagram, Chris.Thrall. Thank you.